What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Julie Seltzer, a soferet, a female Torah scribe. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and a special visit from Sarah Lefton, who has been selling a unique Jewish t-shirt for many years, and last week saw it suddenly become the hottest ticket on the entire internet. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Last Friday, we began the Jewish calendar month of Elul, the last month of the year, when we prepare ourselves for the coming Jewish Days of Awe, the High Holy Days, a little less than 4 weeks from now. Rosh Hashanah begins Friday night, September 18th. The word Elul, the name of this month, is made up of four Hebrew letters, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed. In a beautiful interpretation, these stand in for the words Ani l'dodi v'dodi li, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine, a passage from the biblical book, the Song of Songs. This teaches that at this time of year, God seeks to unify with us, to renew the bonds of love and tenderness that underlie our relationship with the divine, and which are especially available to us during this period of return and renewal. To remind us that tshuvah, repentance and return, are more than a two-day-a-year process, we Jews sound the shofar each day of this month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best we can be, and to apologize to those we have wronged or injured. Blowing shofar is a great way to wake up. Shofar, of course, is a ram's horn hollowed out. You can actually make a real horn shofar of your own. With a bit of practice, you too can blow the shofar. Our school children in our congregation Beit Simcha Religious School are all taught to blow the shofar, although perhaps this year we may wait until the pandemic recedes a little bit. I'm not sure wind instruments are altogether safe to learn to play just now, so you might have to depend on me. In any case, hearing the sound of the shofar is a great way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days. It's an ancient, haunting sound, nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. And so, of course, I brought a shofar along this morning to kind of blow us into the Too Jewish Radio Show today. Well, if you weren't already awake this morning by now, you probably are, aren't you? To play us in this morning in a little more melodic way, and remind us again of these coming High Holy Days, here's a past guest of Too Jewish, Neshama Karlbach, singing B'Sefer Chaim, Write Us in the Book of Life, an important, really central theme of the coming Days of Awe.
B'Sefer Chaim רחב ושלום ופרנסה טובה ניזכר וניכתב לפניך אנחנו וכל עמך Israel
That was Neshama Karlbach and Josh Nelson performing B'Sefer Chaim. Write us in the Book of Life, goodness and blessing in the coming year. May it be a much better year for all of us than the one we are now completing. And by the way, that last shofar call, the Tekiya Gedola, that was just kind of a warm-up for me. I usually work up to about a minute, but that's a lot of time on the air. In any case, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Julie Seltzer, will explain how she became a soferet, a Torah scribe, and the unique challenges she has faced, all when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. The High Holy Days are coming up soon. Make your arrangements. Join Beit Simcha for our blended online and very limited live seating by calling 520-276-5675 or emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. And don't miss our live drive-in second night celebration on September 19th. Music, shofar, and much more, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, will be really fantastic. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times in these days of coronavirus SARS. Join us Friday nights on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them, with my dad, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, assisting. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. We'll be holding our services with full music virtually for the time being, but a few people can come. Let us know if you're interested. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access them by emailing us at beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogue's at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla. We're not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building of the Foothills Mall property. A fully functioning virtual congregation for now, Beit Simcha's on Zoom and Facebook. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend the High Holy Days, Shabbat services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, all taught on Zoom, and of course our services on Facebook, go to beitsimchatucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Beit Simcha Tucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish congregation in southern Arizona for these High Holy Days and our exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning Julie Seltzer. She is a soferet, a scribe who writes Torahs, one of the pioneering women in this profession, which was for the past 2,000 or 2,500 years or something, restricted solely to men. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So what led you to become a Torah scribe?
Wow, that's kind of a long story for a short podcast. But I will say that I've always had a love for the Hebrew language and the Hebrew letters. And one day I was walking down the street. I was actually walking down the street in Jerusalem and had the thought, I want to learn how to write the letters the way they're written in the Torah. And I was not thinking about actually writing a Torah, but eventually everything dominoed, and that is what happened.
Were you always artistically inclined? Do you see writing Torah, doing the calligraphy that's essential to a Torah, as an artistic endeavor, as a spiritual one?
If this was a video, I might show you my drawings, which are basically like stick figures. I am not a visual artist at all. I'm not artistic. My background is also in theater, though, so I'm not sure that that counts. I was interested in Torah writing from something else brought me in, not the visual arts aspect, though I do very much appreciate it. And when I see beautiful calligraphy, I get excited. But my skill did not come naturally. I had to practice quite a bit. And I came to it more from being interested in the book and Torah and in being part of a chain of transmission that goes back quite a number of years.
Who did you begin to study with?
I began studying with Jen Taylor Friedman and continued to study with Jen Taylor Friedman, who is, as far as we know, the first woman to write a Sefer Torah. So that was, we connected back in 2009.
You continue to study with her once you're working on a Torah. What can you do that's better? I mean, it's a curious question.
I continue to improve. I mean, if you are practicing intentionally, meaning if you're writing a Torah, if it's your first Torah, your writing will improve over the course of the scroll. It takes a year to a year and a half to write the scroll, and so necessarily hopefully you're improving a little bit. And this might not be noticeable to a reader, but it's probably noticeable to the person writing it. And certainly from one project to the next, I feel like I've improved to some degree with my with the quality of my writing. And I continue to get advice from teachers about the writing. So that's a continual process.
We will talk much more with Julie Seltzer about the process of writing a Torah and her own journey when we come back here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We have a very special visitor today, but there's a little background to her visit. Here it is, direct from the President of the United States, discussing our national parks.
We want every American child to have access to pristine outdoor spaces. When young Americans experience the breathtaking beauty of the Grand Canyon, when their eyes widen in amazement as Old Faithful bursts into the sky, when they gaze upon Yosemite's towering sequoias.
So President Trump was talking about national parks when he blundered into calling Yosemite National Park Yosemites, not once, but twice. Now, anybody can misread a cue card, of course, but this led to quite a week for our guest, and I'll let her tell you all about it. We welcome to Too Jewish a special guest this morning. Sarah Lefton has created a T-shirt that has gone spectacularly viral. It comes, well, tell us the origin of the shirt.
Hey, I would love to. I was working at a very popular California Jewish summer camp back in the early aughts called Camp Tawanga. It's right outside Yosemite National Park.
Right.
And just for fun, everyone on staff called the park Yosemite. It was just what everyone called it.
Yosemites.
Well, right. I mean, they
but
said
it was
Yosemite.
Yosemites, right.
It was Yosemite. And one time I said something about I'm heading over to Yosemite. oh my God, did y'all see that? You know, I just kind of realized that there was yet another joke in there. So that's where it started. I made a t-shirt just for myself. I have a screen printing gadget at home. I made a shirt, and it was in wearing it out on a hike in San Francisco one day that I ran into some Jewish guys who just started laughing, and they said, "Where'd you get that shirt?" And they encouraged me to print some, and it kind of snowballed from there.
And so suddenly you had a business which was like Yo Semite.
Yes, I called it Jewish Fashion Conspiracy, and I launched that back in 2004. And over time, I sold like 15 different items, you know, from a really popular Yankees t-shirt called Jews for Jeter.
Yep.
To,
by
really
the way,
silly...
I have a shirt of Jews for Jeter because a friend of mine.
You?
Yeah, yeah. And I had no idea that you were involved in this. A friend of mine has a fantasy baseball team in New York called Jews for Jeter that he had me do blessings for when I was back there. And then he sent me the shirt, and I sent a picture of myself in the shirt with a baseball glove. Anyway, so Jews for Jeter is yours. There we go.
That's my baby. That was my best-selling shirt until 2 weeks ago.
And then something happened. Let's talk about that a little bit. It's not often that the President of the United States accidentally plugs your t-shirt business, is it?
I know, seriously. And it happened before I was even awake on Pacific time. You know, I got up at 7 or whatever, and like a moron, you know, looked at my phone first thing. And
of course,
saw,
like everyone else in the world does now, right, anyway, but go ahead.
Right. I saw that I had hundreds of Twitter notifications, and like, I have a lot of fun online, but I'm not the kind of person that gets hundreds of Twitter notifications. So I said, uh-oh, what happened? And when I saw the clip, I couldn't believe it. Like, I couldn't believe it. It was comedy gold.
Not only comedy gold, but, you know, when the President of the United States says for Yosemite, Yo Semite, how
I
many more
yeah.
requests for t-shirts did you suddenly get?
Thousands. And not just, you know, for numbers, but for, you know, immediately. Like, how fast can I get them? You know, so-and-so wants to wear one at his bar mitzvah. Like, really, like, can you overnight me this? Can you send me baby size? We want to give these as baby gifts. Just like everything. It all spilled out.
Right.
And it's funny because these are all requests I've had before. You know, I've been selling this shirt for years.
Right.
So many times over the years. In fact, at some point I did sell youth size t-shirts, and I did sell baseball style t-shirts, and I did make cotton candy colored ones.
Of course.
Like, I'm, you know, this is not a new product.
And so now I should be asking donations from you for my synagogue, because this might be your retirement sinecure here. This is pretty good, Sarah.
I actually am really proud of, there's a piece of this, you know, I work with retail partners, and one of them is the National Museum of American Jewish History.
Oh, that's fantastic.
In Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia,
yeah.
Sure.
And this sales of this shirt have been really meaningful to them, because like everywhere else in the country, that's a public institution, they've been closed for 5 months.
Yeah.
And the revenue really matters to them a lot. So that feels really good.
Well, who knew that like Yo Semite would become a major mitzvah for a lot of people and a wild success? So if people want to get one of these Yo Semite, but by the way, they're cool shirts. Where do they go to find them?
Yeah, so I'm working with three main partners right now. The museum that I just mentioned,
right, in Philadelphia,
right, Namajh, NMAJH. You can look them up. Their website is judaicashop.net, I believe. And moderntribe.com, which is a great website that has all kinds of fun Judaica.
Very fun
and then,
place.
Yeah, and then finally, my beloved hometown Judaica store, Afikomen Judaica in Berkeley, California, has a website. Or you can actually walk into the shop with a mask on and get
yes,
one.
Yes, absolutely. Sarah, thanks so much for coming on Too Jewish, and I hope these Yo Semite shirts continue to be a wild success, not just in this immediate pandemic moment, but forever. Thanks
Yo,
so much.
Thank you.
And Yo Semites, go. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So the way that certain countries have handled coronavirus, you know, it's been very much in the news, of course. Obviously, people think Europe generally handled it better than the United States. But in the Far East, where it originated, there are some really interesting findings. Why don't you share some of that? And it's related to religion.
Yep. There's a Jewish tie-in at the very beginning of this and at the very end.
Okay, good. It is a Jewish show here.
Right.
So just to remind you.
So, first of all, by and large, the countries that have handled this outbreak the best in the world, regardless of which continent they're in, are countries run by women. And it's like 7 out of the 8 best countries are countries where the prime minister and or the president is a woman.
Like New Zealand, Germany.
Taiwan.
Right.
Finland, Norway. The list is endless. Okay. But second of all, I just got a post from a good friend who lives in Western Australia, which, as you know, having lived in Australia, is huge. It's the western half of all of Australia.
Like half of the continent.
Right. So she is the line dance instructor, and she posted a photo of people line dancing. Nobody was wearing a mask. So I said, that picture looks surreal. Why is no one wearing a mask? And she immediately answered that in all of Western Australia, there are 3 cases of coronavirus, all in quarantine, and there has been no community transmission, no local sourced coronavirus cases since April 1st.
Wow.
Which is months and months, April, May, June, July. So nobody needs to wear a mask because there's no cases floating around. There's 3 cases and they're all in quarantine. But the Buddhist miracle to which you referred has been widely studied and reported on in serious journals like The Economist because there's a marked contrast between the success in handling the pandemic in the largely Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia, which are Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and the largely Muslim countries of the exact same region, which are Malaysia and Indonesia. In the first 4, the Buddhist countries, there have been virtually no cases. They just had 3 cases in Da Nang, which is a popular tourist resort in Vietnam, and they essentially expelled or repatriated all the 80,000 tourists who were there, lest they catch the disease and lest Vietnam get a bad name. And they did this at government expense. The remarkable thing, I think, about this contrast is, what is it about Buddhist culture that might lead people to adhere more closely to government guidelines, whereas in Muslim countries, they obviously haven't?
Wearing masks, social distancing, contact tracing.
Washing your hands. I mean, the things we all know. I mean, we can say this in our sleep. We know what to do. We just don't do it here. But the answer would seem to be that, particularly in Thailand, which is the champion, people begin and end every conversation with a nonverbal gesture that means, I salute the godliness within you. So I recognize that you are created B'Tselem Elohim, which is a very Jewish principle. We're all created in God's image. Therefore, we should treat each other with care, with respect, with dignity. And if it means a little inconvenience like wearing a mask to protect your hundreds and thousands of neighbors, of course you're going to wear the mask. And there's no question in those Buddhist countries. For whatever reason, the largely Muslim countries of Indonesia and Malaysia, which are literally next door.
Yeah, they share a peninsula.
Don't have the same spotless record, sadly. And their infection rates are soaring.
Very interesting. B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, from Genesis. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe goes to Dr. Goldberg for his checkup. After extensive tests, the doctor tells him, I'm afraid I've got bad news for you, Moshe. You only have 6 months to live. Moshe is shocked. After composing himself, he replies, that's terrible, doctor. I must admit to you, I can't afford to pay your bill. Okay, says Dr. Goldberg, I'll give you a year. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well for at least a year. now a word of Torah. Most of us who feel positively about religion believe strongly nations should live at peace, that war will someday become an ancient bad memory. They shall beat swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall men learn war anymore, our prophet Isaiah predicted. And almost every religion has similar injunctions encouraging peace. But Isaiah predicted this great time of peace about 2,700 years ago, and it still seems as far away as ever. The historical truth of human civilization is that a war is always going on somewhere, and sometimes everywhere in the world, and that the number of years in which this planet has been free of war is very, very few. One calculation says that of the 3,400 years of recorded human history, only 250 have been free of a documented war. That is, once every 15 years or so, we've had a year without war. To be honest, that seems wildly optimistic. In my lifetime, I cannot recall a single year in which warfare has not been waged somewhere on the globe. Which makes the agenda of the opening section of our Parsha this week, Ki Tetzeh, sadly and strangely appropriate at any time. It does not begin, Im Tetzeh LaMilchama, if you go out to war against your enemy, but Ki Tetzeh LaMilchama, when you go out to war against your enemy. Pragmatically, the Torah treats war as a tragic but inevitable result of human conflict. We hate war. We seek to avoid war at all costs. We know that war is destructive to much of what we believe in and pray for. But we also know that there simply are times when it cannot be avoided, when, in our fallible human ways, we will fall into war. Perhaps the best translation of the Torah here is when you must go out to war. There's an old platitude, all's fair in love and war. But Ki Tetzeh informs us that all is not fair in war, at least, and that we need to restrain ourselves both in our military conduct and the ways in which we re-enter society afterwards. That restraint is essential to our moral claim to serve God through our own actions, to fight for the right. We are obligated to act in ways that sustain and reinforce holiness, even under the exigencies of military necessity. And so our section of Deuteronomy scrupulously outlines the ways in which we must restrain ourselves when forced to engage in warfare. We are not to destroy the productive capacity of the land of our enemies. We are not to exploit captives, women especially, as though they were subhuman. We are to have a cleansing process after battle before we re-engage in civilian society, a physical and psychological re-entry to give us time to readapt to civilian life. Perhaps the greatest lesson for those of us fortunate enough not to be engaged in military conflict is that if rules can be applied to the harshest form of human interaction, to warfare, they can certainly be applied successfully to the lesser friction and source of human interactions that we experience in our own lives. If our ancestors managed to avoid the worst excesses in warfare, we too can learn to avoid the worst excesses that our society presents to us. The conflicts, arguments, and disputes that damage us, damage those around us, damage our world. Perhaps then, if we free ourselves of these excesses of conflict, we can resume our real task, to work to create a world of holiness and blessing in which someday Isaiah's words about the end of war and a time of permanent peace will really come true. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Julie Seltzer, one of the pioneering female scribes in the world, will tell us how she prepares to write a Torah and what's unique about women doing so. Find out when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Kamala Harris, the nominee for vice president on the Democratic ticket with Joe Biden, is married to a nice Jewish guy, Doug Emhoff. If a Hollywood lawyer can be considered a nice guy. Anyway, Emhoff will be taking a leave of absence from his firm as he runs to become the second gentleman, I guess. Is that what we'll call the husband of a vice president if Biden is elected? We've never had to figure that out before. Doug Emhoff was born in Brooklyn, went to Cal State Northridge, got his law degree at USC before becoming a successful entertainment lawyer in L.A. By all accounts, Emhoff's two children from his first marriage call Kamala Harris Mamala. We've had Jewish presidential children and grandchildren, and of course, sons-in-law, but we haven't yet had a Jewish first lady or first gentleman or second lady or second gentleman. Now, if we could just finally get a Jewish president already. Well, not this go-round. In serious news, the ADL, the premier Jewish organization fighting anti-Semitism in America, is unfairly under attack by pro-Palestinian and so-called progressive groups, and its liberal allies are now coming to its defense. Last week, more than 150 groups signed an open letter calling for the ADL to be excluded from social justice coalitions. The effort, called Drop the ADL, criticizes the ADL's work educating police forces across the country about anti-Semitism and hate, as well as its support of Israel. Spearheaded by a coalition of pro-Palestinian and deep left-wing groups that disapprove of the ADL's ties to law enforcement and Israel, this campaign follows earlier pushes against the Jewish anti-bigotry group. Ironically, this smear campaign comes on the heels of a high-profile ad boycott of Facebook spearheaded by the ADL, the NAACP, and other civil rights groups. That boycott recruited more than 1,000 companies, including a range of marquee brand names, to stop advertising on Facebook for at least a month to protest its inaction on hate speech. The signatories to the anti-ADL campaign say that kind of effort, as well as local anti-bias work that the ADL supports, should not cause people to forgive, quote-unquote, other aspects of the ADL's record. The list of 100 signatories includes a motley coalition of groups, such as the Democratic Socialists of America, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, the Movement for Black Lives, Jewish Voice for Peace, and Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. Some of these have previously criticized the ADL, while others are joining in after a summer in which criticism of racial injustice of law enforcement has taken center stage. Liberal Jewish organizations that have worked with the ADL are publicly defending its record as a Jewish civil rights organization with a long track record of standing up for marginalized communities. A coalition of Reform, Conservative, and Reconstructionist Jewish organizations put out a joint statement last week pushing back on the criticism. "We vehemently reject efforts to silence or shun the ADL," the statement reads. "Many of the criticisms that have been made are unjust or distort ADL's long record of commitment to civil rights and its successful efforts in legislatures, courts, schools, and communities to fight discrimination and hate. We remain committed to working in our vital coalitions in close partnerships with the ADL on our shared desire to fight bigotry wherever it may be found." Mark Hetfield, CEO of the Jewish refugee aid group Hias and a past guest of Two Jewish, said, "This smear campaign takes us in the opposite direction of where we need to go. Hias has been working closely with the ADL for over 100 years, and we look forward to working with them for the next 100 years fighting hate and welcoming refugees. The ADL has long been one of Hias's closest and most valued partners and allies in the U.S. as well as Israel. Hias stands with ADL." Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of the liberal Israel lobby J Street and another past guest of Two Jewish, also came out against the boycott campaign. "One can disagree with the ADL over Israel policy, yet appreciate their stand on the travel ban and refugees and their track record on civil rights. I favor engaging, not boycotting, those with whom we might disagree." The ADL called the campaign an attempt by anti-Israel groups to divide the civil rights coalition. "These are many of the same groups who've been pushing an anti-Israel agenda for years," the ADL said. "It says more about them than us. At this moment of great unity around equal justice for all, that they would launch this effort against one of the largest and oldest Jewish organizations in America. They will do nothing to stop the important work we do every single day in close partnership with many prominent civil rights groups to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and secure justice and fair treatment for all." The ADL has historically opposed anti-Semitism and bigotry across the political spectrum. It has previously been the target of criticism from groups on both the left and the right. That must mean they're doing the right thing. In 2018, several of the groups behind the current anti-ADL effort lobbied Starbucks to drop the ADL from its high-profile anti-bias training. Groups on the right, meanwhile, have said the ADL focuses too much on right-wing extremism while giving a pass to anti-Semitism on the left. The ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America, a kind of far right-wing Jewish group, has issued a ream of news releases attacking the ADL for what it sees as going soft on opponents of Israel. This current attack on the ADL draws on its support for Israel as well as its work with police forces, including a broad anti-bias training program, as well as counter-terrorism seminars and delegations to Israel. In many cases, they cite incidents that occurred under the ADL's previous national director, Abe Foxman, another past guest of Too Jewish, who stepped down in 2015. Under its current CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt, the organization has been a frequent critic of the administration and the president's statements and policies regarding Muslims, immigrants, and other marginalized groups. Simultaneously, its research on and reporting of anti-Semitic incidents and white supremacist activities have been widely cited by those seeking to sound the alarm over rising extremism in the U.S. At the very least, this attack on the premier organization fighting anti-Semitism and hate speech in America at this critical time is a perfect example of the ways that organizations seeking social justice often manage to self-destruct. There are many times when, in the name of ideological purity, progressive movements attack the very allies that can help them accomplish their goals of a more just society. Removing the highly respected ADL from social justice coalitions makes them weaker, less effective, less likely to succeed. And anyone who thinks that Palestinian society, in any of its variations, treats all people equally, especially women and minorities, has no actual knowledge of those societies. Just saying. In other news, at age 98, Norman Lear is officially the oldest person ever nominated for an Emmy Award. The milestone is made sweeter by the fact that this year his wife, Lynn Davis Lear, is a fellow nominee. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish Julie Seltzer. She's a soferet, a scribe, writing Torah, writing a Sefer Torah, writing, I guess you're on your, is this your third Sefer Torah you're working on now?
I'm about to complete my fourth roll.
Fourth scroll.
And I was also part of a couple other projects. These were scrolls that were written collectively by a number of women. So, for example, a synagogue in Toronto, five women came together and essentially each one wrote one of the five books of the Torah.
Huh. That's a very interesting program. As someone who's been chanting Torah for way too long, occasionally in going through a Torah, you can see a change in the writing, but most Sefer Torah have been written by one scribe. Tell us about that. Like, how does that feel to be, you know, kind of part of a collection creating a Sefer Torah?
Well, that's correct. I think in most cases, the aesthetic of having the writing being the same handwriting throughout is or a higher value. For this project, one of the values and one of the goals was to give the opportunity to women who might not otherwise have a chance to write a Torah. This is pretty new that women are doing this. So we were excited, and the synagogue was excited about that aspect. Certainly, you could see a shift in handwriting going from one book to the next, because handwriting is like a fingerprint. Even if I tried to mimic my teacher's handwriting, for example, I might come close, but I wouldn't get it exactly. And in fact, if you may have noticed, if you chant Torah a lot, that sometimes a section has been replaced. And a scribe
right.
That's different from the original scribe has rewritten that section. And in that case, we do our best to copy the handwriting of the original scribe. But again, it will not be exactly the same.
You know, it's such a huge endeavor. The scribes that I've known, you know, start out, they'll write mezuzot or they'll, you know, write the text that goes into tefillin. Much shorter passages, then maybe they try the Megillat Esther or something, and then come to the point where they feel comfortable writing a whole Torah. It's a huge endeavor to write a whole Torah, right?
It is a huge endeavor. It's a long endeavor, but there are elements of it that are actually much easier than writing a mezuzah or tefillin, for example, because a mezuzah...
More space to work with, right?
Yes, exactly. It's generally a little bit bigger, a Torah, that is. And there is an additional rule for mezuzah and tefillin that does not apply when writing a Torah, and that is that you have to write it in order. So that has various implications for making mistakes that is more challenging to fix in a mezuzah and tefillin. So, and on the other hand, you can write a mezuzah in a single day, maybe even half of a day, whereas a Torah takes much longer. Yeah.
How long does it take? I mean, people say a year, but that's kind of a loose statement, isn't it?
Yeah, it takes me a little bit longer than that. So if I'm working on it full time, it will take closer to 15 or 16 months when you include things like educational programming and also having the Torah proof for mistakes and all the corrections fixed, kind of all the entire process for me is a bit longer than a year.
You mentioned that a Torah doesn't have to be written in order, but you do try to write it in order, but then if you have to fix something, you can go back and do that, or do you not write it in order?
Not necessarily. So, for example, a scribe might choose to start towards the end of the Torah. Maybe they want to be in sync with the Torah reading cycle as it's happening. Let's say they're starting right now and they want to start with
Deuteronomy.
Right. Or another example, sort of more on a line-by-line basis, there might be a situation where you want to write backwards even. So start at the end of the line and go back towards the middle of the line. And that has to do with which letters you can stretch because the columns have to be aligned.
Boy, that sounds so hard to me. I'm gonna write this sentence, not even this sentence, this section backwards. I'll make a large mem and then fill it in the other way. Wow.
It's not easy. The thing that's hard about it actually is less on the technical level and more that you're prone to make errors because you are writing a word backwards and... Yes, more likely to skip a letter.
There used to be sort of a bias against left-handed Torah scribes. I've never understood that because it always seemed to me that you were less likely to smear if you're writing Hebrew, which goes right to left if you're left-handed.
I don't know about the bias, but there is a rule that if you're right-handed, you have to write with your right hand, and if you're left-handed, you have to write with your left hand. There is a requirement that you write with your dominant hand.
What if you're ambidextrous? What do you do?
So here's where the bias may come in. If you're ambidextrous, I do believe you're supposed to write with your right hand. So in terms of the smudging, it's true that while a right-handed person is more likely to smudge as they start out learning because the Hebrew is going from right to left, left-handed scribes have other issues, and that has to do with in what direction the strokes are made. And so actually another one of my teachers, one of the most renowned Hebrew calligraphers in the world, Izzy Pludwinski, who wrote a book called Mastering Hebrew Calligraphy recently, he is left-handed, and he wrote a whole chapter about lefties and writing. I think that he turns the sheet on its side and writes down.
I don't mean to minimize the sacredness of this task by talking about some of the fun aspects. When you prepare to begin writing each day, what is there a special process? Do you say special brachot, special blessings? There's a mikvah requirement. Like, how does all that work?
Yeah, interestingly, there's a requirement to set an intention at the beginning of a project. So a Torah, before you start writing, you make a statement of intention that you're writing out loud, that you're writing for the sake of the sanctity of the Torah, for the Kedusha of the Torah. And the same is true for a mezuzah or any of the other sacred writings that you write. So for a mezuzah, you'd be saying this intention more frequently. For a Sefer Torah, I like to repeat it, but it doesn't have to be repeated. There are also different prayers, different ways of preparing and getting ready for writing, but they're not required. And this is true as well for the mikvah. It's something that's suggested, but not does not
Torah on kosher if that part has not happened.
Do you do other kinds of calligraphy, other kinds of scribal work while you're working on a Torah? For example, if somebody contacts you about a ketubah or mezuzah or something, do you do other stuff along the way?
I do. It depends on the timeline of the Torah. So if I have the time, then I always like to get a Megillah in.
Throw in a little Megillah along
the
way.
Exactly.
I've taught Zohar for a long time, and in Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, the letters themselves have a tremendous mystical tradition. Some huge amount of mystical power, according to Jewish spirituality. Do you adhere to any of this? Is that part of why you do what you do?
I think I veer more towards the historical lens, and I find it very interesting. I find language, just the fact that we can communicate with each other in written form, abstract ideas, across the ages, I find that incredibly mystical, but I think that's not what you're talking about exactly. I find it interesting that the script has developed and changed. If we look at what script was in use at the time we would place Revelation at Sinai, for example, it's a script that is unrecognizable to us today. So the script that Torah is written in is actually a later script. It's an Assyrian script. It's called Ashurit, and that's what Torahs have to be written in. But it's not the earliest Hebrew script, though it is in Hebrew language. If that makes sense,
it does. So in Hebrew, but not a Hebrew script. That's kind of fascinating.
It is a Hebrew script, but it's not the earliest Hebrew script. And
I see.
It came from that line, but maybe not a direct line. But it was readopted by Jews as the main holy script.
I do find the orthography of Hebrew letters fascinating. Really an ancient language, but it has changed over time, hasn't it? The way that we write letters.
It has indeed.
When you're chanting Torah, there are sort of Ashkenazic style Torahs, and then there are Sephardi style Torahs, which is a very broad category that includes kind of all Eidot HaMizrach. There's difference in the way the letters are written, particularly in the sort of the bifurcation there, that the big split. Which style do you typically use?
I write in Ashkenazi style and what's called the Beit Yosef style primarily. That is what I learned. I could write in other scripts, and it's true. There is, now that there's so much, now because of globalization, essentially, a lot of the more individualized, localized scripts are being lost. I mean, that there is a general kind of split, Sephardi style, Ashkenazi style, but within all of those, there's many, many, many other localized styles that are kind of disappearing. But one telltale way to identify a Sephardi Torah is the bottom of the letter shin is flat as opposed to pointed in Ashkenazi style. So that's kind of one main difference. And a Yemenite Torah actually has some different letters. Not only the script is different, but the letters themselves.
The structure of the letter itself?
Actually, the actual letters. So the letters of certain words of the Torah are different.
Wow. That's the kind of thing that if you're chanting Torah and you see a different letter, you call somebody over and then you go check with a scribe to see if you have to repair the Torah. There's a mistake.
Well, actually, yeah. And if you can't tell if it's a borderline case and you're not sure, does this letter, which is supposed to be a bet, look too much like a kaf, you ask a child.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Never heard that. That's fascinating.
I have actually seen it happen.
I remember chanting Torah once in a congregation and realizing there was a clear mistake, like a letter was just flat out wrong, not missing a word. Now, there's a few things you can do, but the most important thing is to call over a good scribe to look at it, right?
Right. If it's clear that it's a mistake, then the tradition tells us to put the Torah away You're not supposed to read from that Torah, and you have a month to get it fixed.
If there are fewer than three mistakes in a Torah, then you don't have to have the whole thing checked, as I understand. I mean, if you find one mistake, you get that fixed, but you don't necessarily have to go through the whole Torah. Is that true?
I think that that's true.
I figure you're the person to ask. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm not positive. I do know that Torahs are supposed to be checked periodically, but I can't remember how frequently.
How many hours a day do you write when you're working on a Torah?
I write about 5 hours a day, so that I can do a column of 42 lines in about 5 hours.
That's, you know, amazing to me.
And they're not five straight hours. I take breaks, so yeah, it stretches longer.
It sounds painful, actually, at some point. Someone who now spends all his time typing and who used to write terribly. I guess a final question. How does it feel to finish a Torah?
Oh, wow. It's very moving. It's exciting to reach that goal and that end, and knowing that the Torah can now be used and read from and be part of a community. It's also a little bit like saying goodbye to a kid that grows up.
A child. You're sending her off to college.
Yes, exactly. So, knowing that it's time for them to move on, and So there is kind of a bittersweet finality to it, which mirrors the death of Moses at the end of the Torah.
Which is how you finish the Torah, of course, if you write it.
Right, exactly.
I want to thank Julie Seltzer for a wonderful visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you, about writing Torahs, about women writing Torahs?
So I would like to send people to a collective that I'm part of, mostly women Torah scribes. We write all kinds of things, and that's Stam Scribe.
STAMSCRIBES.com.
Exactly.
Think, right?
And that's our collective, and I'm on there too. My website's julieseltzer.net. I'd be happy to, if folks are curious about something or something wasn't clear, there are more follow up questions. I'm happy to.
Or if you happen to need a ketubah or you want a really unique mezuzah, maybe contact you. Thank you so much, Julie. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you so much. And it was really good to connect. And I want to say hello to the entire community in Tucson. I have a relative, a great aunt who lives in Tucson. So
you've now said exactly that.
Thanks.
Thanks again. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from the upcoming High Holy Days, now just 4 weeks away. It's Max Janowski's classic Avinu Malkeinu, Barbara Streisand's recording. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Hillel Halkin, the renowned translator, author, and man of letters, talking about the Jews of India, the B'nai Menashe, about whom he has written most memorably. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.